This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
This weekend, we were honored to have Dr. Ron Paul come to speak at the Mises Institute during our Supporters Summit. And I thought that his speech, given on the topic of Federal Reserve Chairman that he's known on the central bank in general, on monetary policy, on what lies ahead for our country, was so important that I wanted to share it with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Like I say, I don't usually get that type of an applause in Washington, D.C. So it's nice to be out of D.C. and among friends and where the real heart of America is and should be. But it is a delight to be here, and it's good to see Lou, and it's good to see Bert here today and everybody else, all the friends of Liberty. So it's been a really a fantastic past 2 years for me personally, and hopefully for others, that we have made some advances. But things have looked pretty good, and I think that I'm probably a lot more optimistic now than I was 2 years ago. But you know, the old saying that, you know, I'm here from the government, you know, and I'm here to help you. I know you don't believe that, so I can't use that line. But and you probably don't believe this either. If I said I'm here from the Federal Reserve and I'm here to help you, you probably wouldn't believe that one either. But hopefully it will never get to the point where it'll be said that I'm here from Goldman Sachs and I'm here to help you. But it certainly has been an interesting 2 years, and lots of things, of course, has happened. Yesterday, or the day before, right before I was leaving here, I had an interesting phone call from a member of Congress. He's a friend, and he's a conservative Republican. But we've never done anything legislatively together. In other words, he's not hardcore. But he called and put out a message that he needed to talk to me. He was getting ready to make a trip, but he wanted to talk to me before he made this trip. And I thought it might have been one of the, like so many of the members now are calling, because they get into a little bit of political trouble. You know, the leadership of the party, they don't have anything to do with me. But the individual congressman, as soon as they get into trouble, will you give me some money? Will you send out an email? Will you endorse me? Because all of a sudden they know our views are spreading. I thought maybe that's what he was calling me about. But that wasn't it. He called and said that he and his wife have been sitting down and thinking about their investments, and he wanted to know, how do you buy gold? So I said, call Bert Blumert. He'll tell you how to buy gold. So maybe that's a sign of the of a changing time, that people are starting to think that way. But, you know, I think this conference that you've had here, Lou, today's couple days have been just fantastic on an issue that, of course, has attracted my attention for many, many years. I would say it was the issue of money that was the precipitating factor that got me involved in politics in the 1970s, with recognition that the Austrian economists were right. I'd been studying and reading Austrian economics in the 60s, and in 1971, I remember it very clearly, on August 15th, that the Bretton Woods was predicted to be to break down. Matter of fact, it was Henry Hazlitt that very early on, when Bretton Woods was set up, said it wouldn't work. And lo and behold, it failed. And that sort of confirmed, you know, the theory. You know, sometimes I wonder why we still talk about the Austrian theory of the business cycle. And we always call it the theory. Why don't we call it the Austrian explanation of the business cycle? But that certainly got my attention, and talked about it all. Overall, the issue that's always driven me has been the issue of liberty. And yet you can't deal with the overall issue of liberty if you don't deal with the issue of money, because money is a driving force. It is all powerful in a moral sense, in an economic sense, in a constitutional sense. It is very, very vital, because if somebody gets control over the monetary system, they have ominous control and ominous power. And there was a conversation I had with Greenspan a couple years ago, when I pushed him on this issue, on the amount of power he had. I said, you can dictate interest rates. You can decide how much money people who are retired and they're in their CDs, what they're going to earn. And he acknowledged that, and he called it an ominous power that he indeed had. But he said, but it was given to us. The Congress gave it to us. And but that's why he believed very much in openness of the Federal Reserve, and that that people know what they're doing, which is an absolute falsehood, because we don't know exactly what we're doing, and they're doing a lot behind the scenes. But anyway, he did confess up to the fact that there was an awful lot of power in the hands of the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Board chairman. When I first went to Congress, which was in the tail end of the 74 election, which would have been the Watergate year, the chairman of the Federal Reserve at that time was Arthur Burns. And so I was on Financial Service or the Banking Committee all the years I've been in Congress. So there's been a few Federal Reserve Board chairmen I've seen before the committee. Burns was there, of course, and stayed a good while. Not that I was there that many years when he was chairman, but then G. Williams Miller came in. Then, of course, he didn't last long, and we had those terrible problems at the end of the 70s, and they brought in Volcker. Volcker, I did have a fair amount of experience with him. And then, of course, after Volcker, Greenspan, and then Bernanke. It's been a few people, a few individuals that have served as Federal Reserve Board chairman. But I think the overall atmosphere of the relationship of the members of Congress, or especially with me, have evolved a bit since that time. You know, the two that I was most fascinated with and thought about old times was both Burns and Volcker, but for rather silly reasons. Because when I think about it, they were actually allowed to come to the committee room and smoke a pipe and smoke a cigar right in the hearing room. But no, not anymore. Now, I can't stand smoke. I hate the smell of smoke. It's horrible. It's bad for your health. But there's still something mystical about the fact that somebody could actually sit, stand in a building there and smoke, you know, and old Burns would there be playing with his pipe and then, of course, Volcker smoking those horrible cigars. But things have changed. But attitudes have changed, too. I know when Lou was working with me up there, we would have conferences, and actually right after he started the Mises Institute, we had a gold conference up there, and we could get Federal Reserve Board chairman to come out and participate. Partee was one that participated, and Wallach used to be on TV debates with me. And Volcker was really a gentleman about it all. I can remember when we were working on the Monetary Control Act, which I believe would have been 1980. And he was pushing hard for this, and this was giving a lot more power to the Federal Reserve. And the two things that bothered me the most was, one, the authority for the Federal Reserve to take reserve requirements down to zero if he wanted, and also that he could buy anything he wanted, not only domestically, but he could buy foreign debt. And but he was annoyed and disturbed by the fact that I was saying this out in public. So he invited me to a personal breakfast, something that would have never happened by Greenspan or Bernanke. They wouldn't do that. But Volcker felt it was important enough that he get me over there and explain to me the Monetary Control Act. And this breakfast can be verified because I had Lou go with me. And the interesting thing that happened there, it must have been in end of 79, and we walked in, Lou and I walked in, and Volcker's staffer was there. And we chatted a bit, and then Volcker came in. And Volcker did not come over and shake my hand or say hello. He immediately went to his staffer, and he asked him, "What is the price of gold?" So they do pay attention to the price of gold, and it is their interest to know what the price of gold is. I think that is still just as important today to the members of the Federal Reserve and to the monetary establishment around the world. What is the so-called price of gold? Which means they're asking, what is happening to the perception of the value of the dollar. So I think they're still intensely interested in that. But we did have this discussion about the Monetary Control Act, and he kept arguing his case, oh, no, it's not going to do this, it's not dangerous. But I remember at the end of it, he conceded. He says, yes, he says, that is true, that we could take reserve requirements down to zero if necessary. And if we had to do something like bail out a foreign country, we could do this. But he said, we would never do it. And, you know, a few weeks ago, Volcker came before the Joint Economic Committee, and I happened to bump into him in a receiving room. Just he and I talked for a bit, and he was interested in chatting. And I didn't do it, but I think I should have. And the thoughts that crossed my mind was, what did I tell you about that Monetary Control Act? Look at what they're doing. They don't even take it down to zero. It's minus zero now. You don't have to have anything, and they'll keep giving you everything you want. You know, it makes no difference whatsoever. I didn't do that, but he was fascinated with a friendly chat, but his story was the same. Nothing has changed, so I think he's still a big central banker, obviously, but probably a little more decent individual than the more recent Federal Reserve Board chairman. So it is something, of course, that to me has been crucial and so important. Today, a lot is going on financially. Nobody needs to go very far to figure that out. But in many ways, it's a wonderful thing happening for us because we're getting more attention about this issue. I know a lot of the establishment don't want to hear about what we're talking about in sound money, but something has happened. Something dramatic has happened, and it's happened in these last 2 years. My goal had always been to talk about the issues, believing sincerely a major crisis would come. Hopefully, I could participate in the discussion and debate and how it would be rebuilt, how the system would be rebuilt. But I think it's very, very clear that what we're witnessing today is the end of that second stage of the Bretton Woods. It's the dollar standard with no relationship to gold, and it's lasted since 1971. And I think in the last several months, the declaration has been made. It's a non-viable system. I think they know it. I think we know it. I think the Congress doesn't have any idea what's going on. But it's very clear that the current system isn't maintained, and it has to be replaced by something. And I think they are scurrying around like crazy. They do admit there's going to be a global summit, and there's going to be the discussion, but the plans are being laid. I do not believe that they are quite ready to accept our views, but the discussion is out there. But what has happened during the campaign and since then is, to me, rather remarkable, because I've had more opportunity than ever before to get our message out on the more conventional stations. And, you know, what astounded me in the campaign was the attention. You know, people said, well, you didn't get enough attention. They sidelined you, and they wouldn't cover you, and they complained about it. But, you know, after that little minor altercation with the mayor of New York City, whatever his name is, you know, somebody in the media came up to me and they said, well, are you ready to quit and ready to get out? This was about a week after that little incident. They said, aren't you going to quit and get out of the race? I mean, like, you were humiliated and proven completely wrong and all this. And I said, you know what? I said, in the last week, I said, I got more attention than I did in the 30 years I've been in campaigning. So I wasn't about to back down on that. But the need for a global summit is obvious there. But what we do and what they do and how they should have an understanding is completely different. I mean, if you wanted to get together and agree that we're going to have sound money and everybody's going to have their currency defined by a weight of a precious metal, that's one thing. But the plans now for the global summit is something else. Sarkozy from France has been very clear on what he wants to do, and now I think he's pretty good friends with Bush, and they get along fine. And Sarkozy says, well, what we need to do at this conference is revamp capitalism. it's capitalism that is so bad. And but I don't think you should worry about that, because our president is standing up for us. And the president said that he's all for the global summit with the one condition that we not violate or abuse any free market principles. So we have nothing to worry about. He will take care of us and make sure that we have sound economic principles applied to this summit. But I see what's happening is that they've conceded that the dollar standard that we have is at an end. But they probably have gotten together, which they do all the time, and we're not allowed to know what we do, because it's literally in the code, exempted from ever auditing or knowing what the Federal Reserve does, especially on international corporations and international discussions. You cannot have any access to that. There is absolutely no oversight as far as what they do. I believe they've gotten together, and they're willing to temporarily do what they can to prop up the dollar. You know, keep the dollar on the international exchange markets reasonably valuable, valued, and then with the idea that the plans will be laid to come up with a new system. So what is happening today probably is very, very temporary, because they know they can't sustain it, and then there will be this announcement. And this is just a continuation of what I think George Bush Sr. became more bold about when he talked about international finance. He was the first president to say that we do indeed need a new world order. And this is part of that. This is the continuation of a new world order, and they are going to come up with a new program. Our side will have a tough time. The only thing we have on our side is truth and the right economic views, and ultimately, I believe they can prevail. And we have tools today that we didn't have before. We have tools that through the internet, I think it's fantastic. I think we have more and more people joining organizations like the Mises Institute that is getting this information out. This is why I've always admired what the Mises Institute does, because it's not to have a group of people together and talk about it and talk to the choir, but it's to spread these views and talk to teachers and promote it and have new teachers come out and influence the next generation, and that's what counts. So the prevailing attitude of the people, to me, is key. That is the most important if we're ever to undermine this system of banking. And it is indeed the banking system that is allow so much corruption. And when you just think about the power of the Federal Reserve, think about off budgeting. I mean, when the Fed can come in and inject $1 trillion. I mean, it's not authorized by the Congress. I mean, where did we, the people, where have we been? Why have we allowed this? It's not only $1 trillion, it's a couple trillion or $3 trillion. And what are they doing with this? They're propping up bad people. It's all the bad people that are getting this. They're the ones that are getting the money. What are they doing? They're fighting wars that they're not supposed to be fighting. They're propping up a welfare state that shouldn't even exist. And yet, hardly anything is said. And here we are on the verge of this, in the middle of a major crisis, because we've allowed this to go so far. You know, they talk a lot about moral hazard, that encourages people to make bad mistakes and to take more risks than they would ordinarily. But I've often wondered why they call it moral hazard. I keep thinking of it being an immoral hazard that's going on. And so there's a lot of immorality going on out there, and there's a lot of people making a lot of mistakes. But just think of what contributed to this fiasco that we're dealing with now. Federal Reserve, of course, are the ones who have been most responsible in a way, because they've controlled the monetary system. And under Greenspan, just look at what he's done. You know, took interest rates down to 1%. Of course, that caused trouble, and we thought, well, they'd never get back down to 1% again. But isn't it like last week? It's back down to 1% again. Too much inflation, too much money. That's the problem. How do you solve that problem? too much money, too much inflation, more spending. So it goes on and on. But not only did you have the Federal Reserve System creating too much money, but you had other things too that not a lot of people talk about. Were very important to cause people to make mistakes. How about the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation? I mean, that in itself is a major contributing factor. This whole idea of valuing assets, you know, at a certain level, that's very important. They should be set by the market. But we have an SEC that's involved in trying to set the value of assets. So at one time, they think that assets should be, they mandate that they be at a certain level below the market asset. Then they come along and say, okay, all of a sudden what we're going to do is reverse this trend and set them at another rate, just causing more and more chaos. But can you imagine how smoothly that could work if you had a private FDIC that was monitoring each individual bank, that would be measuring the viability of the bank, and insurance rates may go up, and the consumer and the customers would know. And if they were not valuing their assets correctly, then the insurance company or somebody else would be able to tell us that. It would happen on an individual bank, but never completely. With all the banks together on how they measure these things and how detrimental this interference have been. And, of course, to add fuel to this, we had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Here's a program that was designed, of course, it lasted for a long time, so it must have been good. It came out of the 30s. But the seeds had been planted in the 30s. But it was only in the last decade or two that you could see what was forming. And it was not too many years ago, probably about 8 or 9 years ago, I had a piece of legislation in that said that, you know what we ought to do? Is remove the line of credit to the Treasury. And they said, well, why do that? They've never used it. It's only $2 trillion or $2 billion. Of course, that wasn't very much, but didn't matter. But it was the atmosphere that the Treasury would always bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and therefore they had lower interest rates, and that, of course, contributed tremendously to it. But the one thing you better not dare attack and say that contributed to it, because this is politically incorrect, to suggest the CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, had something to do with it. I mean, we wouldn't want to do that, because then you just don't like poor people. But I guess if you did like poor people, maybe we would have a better system where houses aren't taken from the poor people. You give it to them, and then they say, oh, who's losing their houses right now? The poor people. If we're for the poor people, why wouldn't we be for lowering the price of houses? Housing prices are too high. Poor people can't afford them. Well, good. That means we ought to allow the market to lower housing. But what's our policy? Keep the prices of houses up, so that they the poor people can't buy their houses. Oh, if they can't, well, we'll give them more money. So, you know, it goes on and on. They have no understanding, no conviction, no confidence that freedom works. And I am convinced that freedom does really work. But in addition to contribute to this crisis, we've had the HUD programs insisting that you make the bad loans, and also the threat by the courts. Some of these laws are written that if you don't do what you're told to do, if you're in the banking system and you don't do this, you could be fined up $500,000 for doing it. So why not do it, especially if you can make a killing? I'll make the loans, I'll sell them and get rid of them. And then it will satisfy the law, and then lo and behold, a bubble is formed. But what are we doing today to try to correct this? These programs and these solutions are orchestrated so much by the politicians and by the central bank that we're ending up with a system where the poor people now have to bail out the rich people. We have the innocent people bailing out the guilty people, as well as we're relying on the sound investments, the people who invested wisely, put down payments and are making their payments, and they've done decent investments. They have to be punished to bail out the people who did the bad investment. Everything is turned on its head. One of the basic principles that I believe that we fail to follow, and it's very clear in the Constitution that we should not be doing, and we've done it from the beginning in this business of on the housing bubble, interference in the contract going in, and now interfering in the contract going out, saying that, you know, if you have sold a mortgage and you want to foreclose, they're essentially saying, oh, no, you can't foreclose. You're going to have to do this, and you're going to have to make sure that nobody is thrown out of their house. The limited responsibility of the government is to enforce contracts, but instead they're meddling in contracts all the time. That basic principle is not talked about a whole lot, but the government is involved in the contract all the time. I mean, it's constantly, whether it's the price of assets, the regulations that we have, it's the price of labor, wages, and on, the government is constantly involved in contract. But what about the contract that the people and the government should have about soundness in money? The contract ought to be that we shouldn't have any counterfeiters out there. You and I aren't a lot of counterfeit. Why do we allow our government to counterfeit? It makes no sense whatsoever. The Coinage Act of 1792 didn't like counterfeiters, and they said that anybody that was caught counterfeiting would receive the death penalty. I don't know whether we should apply that to the Federal Reserve or not, but they considered it very serious. The problem is, of course, they think only counterfeiting is taking a piece of paper and counterfeiting the paper. But counterfeiting is destroying the value of money by duplication of money illegally, and that's what we've been doing. You know, with Alan Greenspan, over the years, he came to the committee, and I had a fair number of conversations with him, both on and in the committee and out of the committee. And I did at one time on a casual conversation bring up the subject of Murray Rothbard, and he indeed said that he knew Murray and had nothing negative to say about him, but it was a brief conversation. I know Murray had a different opinion, or a very strong opinion, about Greenspan. But some of you have heard this story before, but I'll tell it again in case you haven't heard about it. But everybody, I think, remembers and knows that Alan Greenspan, at one time, you know, was a gold standard person. And he wrote for Ayn Rand, and he wrote in the Objectivist newsletter, and his Golden Freedom article was fantastic. And one time was coming before the banking committee, and we had a chance to meet before that and get a picture taken. And I knew that he was coming, so I dug out my original copy of the Objectivist newsletter, which was at that time, if anybody remember, was a green little booklet. And I was reading that. That would have been, you know, all through the 60s, I guess. So I dug that out and dug up the article. So when I had my chance to have a couple minutes with Greenspan, I walked up and I showed him his faded green book. I says, "Do you recognize this thing, this book?" And he said, "Yeah." He says, "I recognize that." And so I flipped it open to the page with his special article in there. And I said, "Do you remember this article?" And he said, "Yes, he did." And I said, "Well, I'd like you to autograph this article." So he took out his pen and he autographed it. And while he was doing it, I said, "Do you want to put a disclaimer on it?" And then he said something which was rather astounding. He says, no, he said, very serious. He says, "I've just read that recently," he says, "and I stand by every word of it." So, but you know, in about the last meeting we had when he was getting ready to leave, about a year before he was ready to leave, he was reappointed. And, you know, Republicans and Democrats, one after another, about 15 of them just sort of bowed to the maestro. And so when I had my turn, as politely as I could be, I said, you know, I said, I can't quite join in that. I said, "My suggestion is why don't you leave right now while the getting is good?" But he didn't take me up on that. And I always thought he'd get out of town before he'd be blamed for anything. But it looks like he is going to be blamed for a few things. And that is good. I mean, he's responsible. And I thought it would all fall on Bernanke. But fortunately, they have put a lot of blame on Greenspan. But, you know, Greenspan came before the banking committee not too long ago as a former chairman, and he had this paper. This was probably within a month or so, and explanation of this. And I guess the best way I could describe this testimony was pretty pathetic. You know, it was in a way really sad, you know, because when you think of where he was and where he is today, and then he came, and it looks like he's desperately trying to save his image, but he's going wrong. And instead of saying, "I confess all my sins and I'm going back to my 1966 article," no, he's gone in the wrong direction and saying everything wrong. But he had several points I want to go over with you that he made in this hearing. The first thing he said that we must do in order to get out of this crisis is stabilize prices. You know, make sure the housing prices do not drop, because as Paulson said, it's the dropping of the housing prices that is all the fault. And if we could just stop the dropping of housing prices, everything would be okay. So that's what Greenspan said we do. We have to maintain housing prices. And then we have to recognize that private credit won't work. What we need to recognize that the only thing that can save us is sovereign credit. So we need more government credit. Of course, that had nothing to do with our problems whatsoever. But he did allude to what he thought was the real problem. And he put the blame on the securitizers, because they produced excessive demand for the securities, and therefore they were at fault. If they wouldn't have been buying these things, and the whole thing is, it was the principle of bundling and securitizing that was evil. And of course, that principle is not necessarily bad. I mean, if it's done honestly and above board in a free market. But he says, no, it was an excessive demand. But then he did want to apologize in a way about the program that he was using, the computer economic program, because it didn't work quite the way it should have. And he said that it was flawed because it didn't take it didn't have a long enough time span. You know, they were calculating in the past 10 years and everything was okay, and it should have been longer, and therefore it was a flawed computer program. So everybody here that understands the free market and you understand computers, so you got to make sure your computer program works. Don't worry about any human action being involved at all. It's the computer's fault if it doesn't work out. And then on top of all this, he said, what we need are more regulations. That's where he really screwed up. He says the fact that we could have derivatives out there and not have enough regulations, that is the real problem. So if we'd have only go back and do that, we would be much better. And then he comes up and he says, what we need now is to make sure that we do have a subprime market, but it be sustainable. I mean, how much worse can this get? But then he finished on a very positive note. He says, don't worry, the crisis will pass and we'll be okay. So all we have to do is listen to this. And I thought, what a sad ending to this career, which could have been so different if he would have just taken, a different approach. But, you know, the place where we are today is crucial. It's not, this election isn't crucial. You know, what difference does it make, really? You know, absolutely no difference whatsoever. But we do live in very, very important times on the direction that we go in. And we talked in our campaign a lot about change. And And we rallied a lot of young people and a lot of people interested in what we were talking about. A lot of enthusiasm. It still exists out there, probably more than I ever dreamed it would be. And it was very, very encouraging. But when you look at what's happened in the Obama campaign, I mean, what this is really something, something pretty amazing going on. The number of people involved. Can you imagine the dollars involved? I am convinced in my own mind that probably from 2.5 to 3 years ago, when his real campaign started, there's probably been well over $2 billion worth of publicity and advertising going in into that campaign. Because for a year or so before he even announced, I mean, just think of the positive publicity that came up on 9 out of 10 TV stations. And that's a very, it's hard to measure the value of that. And he's tapped into it. The American people are sick of what they're getting in Washington. They're sick of the fact that they don't have enough money and prices are going up. And they're sick of war that continues forever and ever. And they're sick of people who live off the welfare state. And they're sick of bailing out Wall Street. They indeed do want change. So where are they going? They're going to Obama for change. And what change is there? All this talk about change, even McCain is talking about changing and trying to disavow Bush, and we need to change things. We need to do this and this and make a difference. But all they're talking about is the change in the management of the same system, the management of a flawed system, a management that couldn't care less about freedom and the rule of law and personal liberty and sound money. They don't care about that. They care only about the management. There is a contest going on, not in idea. There's a contest going on who's powerful management group. But I am also convinced that those who really are in charge of foreign policy and monetary policy are not worrying that much about who wins and who loses, because they both are going to just continue to manage the same very, very flawed system. And that will not bring about anything to our benefit. It will just perpetuate our problems. And so what we have to do, though, is we have to continue this effort, because the opportunity is there. The opportunity there is for us to really have an impact, bigger than ever before. I mean, we have all been astounded. And Lou and others who have been out and have heard some of the talks and they've been on the road, for individuals in the crowd to start applauding when you say Austrian economics. I mean, this is pretty amazing. And of course, the one episode that I sort of found fascinating was at the university, you know, that radical leftist school, the University of Michigan, that went over there after we had the debate at Dearborn. And that was where it first dawned on me that these college kids, you know, they seem to be up on some of this, because then I got to talking about a little bit about the monetary policy. So a bunch of them pulled out their Federal Reserve notes and started burning them. And then every once in a while at these rallies, and I didn't start this. I didn't have a hold up a sign, but they started this chant, end the Fed. I mean, what's going on here? So, but in talking to so many young people who I met after the rallies, or they come to my office, I'd ask them, what was the issue that caught your attention? And it wasn't always the same. Sometimes it was just, I like your emphasis on the Constitution. But a lot of them would say the monetary issue. The one that I sort of got a kick out of, and I think is sort of fascinating, is, well, we thought you were the only one that was telling the truth. You know, in a way, that is rather sad, because you hear other candidates mumbling sort of similar viewpoints. You know, oh, yeah, we got to be blonde. You know, we take an oath to obey the Constitution and this sort of thing. And I'd point that out to them. They said, yeah, but they just didn't sound like they were telling the truth. And so young people are perceptive. You know, and they do notice the difference, and there's a fertile field out there. There is no reason for us not to be optimistic enough to believe that many, many of those young people who are rallying around Obama are open to our ideas. There is no doubt in my mind that they are. Reaching them is another story. It's not that easy. But this economy is going to be in shambles for a long time, and our views not only make good economic sense, they make good constitutional sense, good moral sense, but it's so logical. You know, it just makes common sense that that our views should prevail and can prevail, and this is very appealing. So we need to, you know, increase our efforts and not get too downhearted and thinking, well, you know, things are rather tough. The foreign policy is an absolute disaster. You know, the other night was on TV, I was complaining about, nobody asked Obama and McCain, have you heard it? Anybody ask him about, you know, why are we bombing Syria? And why are we bombing Pakistan? And why are we planning on bombing Iran? And why are we occupying Afghanistan forever and Iraq forever? I mean, they don't really even get into that. But as bad as all that is, and as much as I'm convinced that foreign policy will not change under Obama, some are deceived into believing that, oh, yeah, he's going to bring the troops home. Sure. But you know what? The troops are going to come home. They are going to come home, just the way the Russian troops had to go home, too. And that we should look as a positive. Yes, we haven't deserved much of the prosperity we've had because it's been based on borrowed money and trust in a dollar that's not trustworthy. We've been able to print money and spend them overseas. We've become a consumer nation, but we have to pay for it. And that's what this whole financial crisis is about, is paying back for the things that we've done over these several decades. But we will be bringing our troops home. And because they will not trust the dollar forever. And that will be good. But the big question is do we want some semblance of a republic, or are we going to have this dribble about pure democracy and thinking that, you know, as long as there's 51%, stick it to the 49% just because they produce everything. It doesn't matter. 51% more, they get what they want? No, that has to end. We have to defend our position. I think we're fortunate in the fact that we have great traditions in this country. We do have at least a memory of property rights. We have a memory where contracts weren't to be interfered with. And we have a memory where the government was supposed to be minimal. And we have a document reasonably written. And even with its imperfections, If we followed what we have, we wouldn't be doing so badly. So it isn't the document. The document in many ways is irrelevant. It's the people who are in charge, the people that we ask to take care of government functions in a proper way. It's getting enough people in Washington with men of integrity, people that you can believe. This is what makes the difference. Because if you say it's only the document, a document doesn't work, of course it doesn't work. And it's not the failure of the document, it's the failure of the people. Is it the failure of the politician? No, it's the failure of the people. And that's why attitudes and ideas are so important. What our teachers are teaching, what the bureaucrats are saying, what the media is saying, and what our talk show hosts are saying, this is what really counts. And I sense that there is now a subtle shift, and at least more questioning going on. I notice the difference because even within the last year, of course, being in a campaign is one thing. You're less likely to get attention. Being out of a campaign, it's less threatening. But there are some serious questions being asked today. And I think we should thank all of you who have been involved in education and promoting, all of you who have been supporters. Many of you have been supporters of mine over the years for the various things I've done. And you're all supporters of the Mises Institute. This makes a difference. People keep asking me, what should I do as an individual? How can I make a difference? I tell you what, everybody has to do something, but it couldn't be different. I mean, it's not going to be the same. What Lou does is different than what I do. And if you're a teacher, you do something different. If earlier today somebody was talking about making a documentary, people have talents. Everybody has a role and a responsibility. And besides, sitting sitting back and doing nothing or hiding in the woods or trying to find a safe haven in Europe or someplace, that doesn't excite me as much as saying, why can't we change what we have here? As difficult as it is, I mean, that's where our fight is principally. But it is a fight. It isn't a political struggle as much as it's an idea. It's a fight over ideas and the proper ideas. So in this manner, I would say keep up the progress. Let's continue this momentum. There's no reason to be discouraged. And all the problems that we have, look at it as opportunities. Troops coming home, that's good. Running out of money for the welfare state, that's fine. Emphasizing the need to go to work, that's pretty good. That's not reward people who don't save money. It's reward to people who do save money. Make sure the prices of houses go down so the poor people can buy houses once again. This is what we need. These ideas and views are logical. They make common sense. They appeal to a lot of people. They appeal to young people. And one thing that delighted me about the young people, they could see the connection about self-responsibility, self-reliance, and allowing people to do with their own personal life with what they want, and connecting that with economic freedom. For so long, we have divided this up. One group of people go out there defending economic freedom. Oh, yeah, we want the market to work. But what you do with your own body, what you eat, drink, and smoke, and how you act, and your sexual preference, all that, that's not good for you to make your own decision. But believe me, young people know and understand that. And the fact that you can reach them in different way, if they like economic freedom, you can teach them about the other. If they like personal liberty, you can teach them about economic freedom. And it is not too many of the young people that get turned off by saying, I don't want to send you off to war. I don't want to ever have a draft. I don't want to ever do this to you. We shouldn't be going to war unless it's declared. We shouldn't be financing war through inflation. And young people like this. They are not anxious to go back to the third and fourth time to Iraq. One of the things during the campaign that I enjoyed the most was the fact that when they were putting me down so often in Congress and on the road, that's un-American, that's unpatriotic, you don't care about the troops. And lo and behold, guess what? When they added up the dollars in the primary races, if you added up all the dollars of all the other candidates, even the Democrats, our campaign got more money from active duty military than all the rest put together. One more comment about the summit reminds me of what one of the Federal Reserve Board chairmen told me one time in the committee when I brought this up about the immorality of devaluing a dollar. It was theft, and you were punishing certain individuals. And they stuck by their guns, and they said that, yes, we want to do this. The dollar needs to be lower. And the only thing they were interested in was making sure that it was orderly. So if they're going to stick you with devaluing your money, just so it's orderly, you're not supposed to get upset. So if you lose 1% of your purchasing power a month, that's not so bad. That's only 12% a year, so you shouldn't worry about it. But if it's 10% in 1 month, now that's disorderly, and that will disrupt things. And, of course, that's what they're fighting for now, to keep this transition from this dollar standard into the next phase. They want to make it as orderly as possible. And right now, I think they're doing, from their viewpoint, doing a fairly good job because they're able to bail out their buddies, and they're able to punish the innocent. But this will all change. But I do want to close by once again praising the Mises Institute for all their hard work and all the work that Lou has done and all the support that Bert Blumert has given to the institution. I'm proud that in the early years I helped the institute get started, and it's done a tremendous amount of work. I did not believe at the beginning that it would be as large and as influential it is now, because on the road when I would talk to people, there were various people I said, what got your interest? And one of the things they said, well, it was Lou Rockwell and the Mises Institute. And likewise, I would like to say that a lot of individuals that I have met and have heard me talk have gone in the other direction because of my support. They have found the Mises Institute as well. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@LouRockwell.com. And thanks for listening.